Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Oscar Weber to tell us all about his book titled Negotiating Relief and Freedom, Responses to Disaster in the British Caribbean, 1812 to 1907, published by Manchester University Press. This is a really interesting, intriguing book that makes, I think, some important points kind of for the particular place and time. So the British Caribbean during this time period, but also helps us understand some longer term trends as well, helps us understand British Empire more broadly, helps us understand some of the disaster responses we see today in the Caribbean, unfortunately. So this book is doing a lot of really interesting things to help us unpack words like disaster, like relief, like what does it mean to be free and what role did the British Empire play in all of this? So Oscar, thank you so much for being with us to tell us all about your book.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for your kind words and the introduction there.
Before we get into your book, would you mind introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this?
Yeah, so obviously, as you said, I'm Oscar, and I did my PhD in history at the University of Leeds. And from there, I lectured at LSE and held a research fellowship at the Institute for Latin American and Caribbean Studies at the University of London. So this focus of the Caribbean has really been, in my work and in my teaching for a long time. I actually, in many ways, the seeds for this book almost go all the way back to my undergraduate degree. I was studying third year, was thinking about dissertation topic, and I was looking at the module catalogue. It must have been in the second year of my, at the end of my second year, I was looking at the module catalogue, and I saw this module, which I think, I'm paraphrasing here, but was essentially disasters in history. And obviously that jumped off the page straight away, and I was really interested and thinking, well, I had that kind of conception of, well, disasters are kind of the purview of geographers, etc. So how would that work, disasters in history? I picked this module, it sounded really interesting, and it kind of linked into an interest I'd already been building in environmental history. I'd been really started to get interested in the kind of reciprocal relationship between humans and their environment. So actually, the disaster part of this leapt off the page, but also it really fit with where I was going with my kind of studies already. And this module was run by a scholar, Greg Bancroft, and he's really influential to me in bringing, I suppose, this idea of critical disaster studies and exploring the role in which the historian can play in the study of disaster. And so I got into this topic, and then it came to dissertation time, and I was looking for, what disaster could I study? And I did lots of looking and reading and researching, and came across the disaster, one of the disasters mentioned in this book, the 1907 earthquake. In Kingston, well, largely it's in Jamaica, but it largely hits Kingston. That's where the central part of the damage was. And this was a fascinating event, which we might talk more about in the course of this conversation. But it was a really fascinating event, and there wasn't really anything written about it. And so, you know, that was a clear thing to get started on. There wasn't much written about it. But also, it was a disaster that took place within the British Empire. So on a practical point, lots and lots of the records that I would need to go and study this event were located in London at the National Archives. So I just dived in from there, really, and got really, really interested in it. And the further I went with the topic through my studies and postgraduate into my PhD, you know, it became clear that there was a lot to write about and really contribute in this respect about this topic. So yeah, it started with this first study of this earthquake in 1907 in Jamaica, and kind of blossomed from there.
Well, so that actually I find really interesting, because the title of the book obviously has a lot of things in it, and we'll get into the various components. But of course, as a historian, I sort of immediately go for the date range, right? And you end the focus in 1907. So I suppose if that's kind of where you started, in a lot of ways, you then went backwards. So can you tell us about why you chose to focus on 1812 to 1907, given what you've just told us about sort of the backstory or the origin story of the book?
Yeah, certainly. So it kind of, as the project developed, and I pursued this a bit when I was doing postgraduate studies before I did my PhD, I'd looked at this earthquake 1907 in Jamaica and found that really, really interesting. And I wanted to kind of, you know, explore it further. There was so many kind of interesting themes that were emerging out of that study. And I kind of looked at the historical records and, you know, in the decade previous to the 1907 earthquake, there'd been a major hurricane in Barbados in 1898, and then the eruption of La Soufrière in St. Vincent in 1902, somewhat overshadowed by the Martinique eruption, and that took place parallel basically in the same week to that. But there was these other two events, and it became clear again that there was, as I studied them, there was themes and just fascinating kind of trends and threads that were connecting them to 1907, particularly in terms of the British response, even though, you know, we were talking about three separate places, Barbados, St. Vincent and Jamaica. And so once I'd kind of studied those in depth and saw the way that they linked to 1907 and helped me explain some of the response and the way in which people were treated and the way in which the kind of relief effort or the response took place after that, it was kind of like, oh, as I got to the point of, you know, being able to do a PhD, it was like, oh, there's certainly a whole kind of interesting, you know, study to go back and look at this. And obviously, you know, we'll probably touch upon this multiple times today, you know, the big pivotal change in the Caribbean, the abolition of the slave trade in 1807, and then later the ending of slavery and its following by apprenticeship. So it just seemed that, oh, the Caribbean had always experienced these disasters, hurricanes in particular, on an annual basis. There was so much to go back and explore. So yeah, it was quite, now I think about it, you bring that up, it was kind of strange almost working backwards from where the book would eventually end. But it just kind of fell naturally as I sought to kind of explain more and more the factors that were shaping the colonial response. The only way was to go back and see where they had come from, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that makes quite a lot of sense. And I think we're going to do a bit of that excavating where things come from, though obviously in a bit of a highlights fashion. The detail is in the book, but we should, you know, hopefully get to some of those big concepts in our discussion. So now that we have an idea of kind of where this project came from, the time period that it covers, I think it's probably worth starting with how natural disasters at the time were understood, because as you said, these are annual events, right? Hurricanes still happen. It's, I think, too easy to sort of assume that the way we think of them is the way that they were thought of in the 18th century, but not so much. So how were disasters understood by people in charge in the 18th century?
Yeah, so it's a complex question, I guess. And it's one I try to address quite a bit in the first chapter of the book. And what I'm really doing in that first chapter, and this, you know, relates to your question, is exploring the way in which the 18th century, in many respects, marked a shift. And with any shift in thinking, in this case, from a totally kind of providential or religious understanding that disasters were the product of God to a more, we could say loosely, scientific understanding, that shift, it doesn't have a neat start and end point. And so, you know, I look at in the book, in that first chapter, some big pivotal events in that respect that shaped and prompted people to think differently. The most famous is obviously the one that I mentioned in there, is in the first chapter, is the Lisbon earthquake, which took place in 1755 in Lisbon. And, you know, in the 17th century, still, as I mentioned in the book, there's an earthquake in 1692 in Jamaica. It's unbelievably devastating. It sinks effectively the first capital of Jamaica. Port Royal is built on this sandbar out into the sea, and this earthquake in 1692 basically sinks the city. It causes liquefaction, so the seismic energy causes the sand to basically stop acting as a solid, and the town itself basically gets sucked into this giant sinkhole, which is then infilled with the sea. And that, you know, that event is just so just shocking, to say the least, for the people who survive and witness it. You know, that event is really understood as a product of God's wrath for this notorious kind of den of iniquity, of piracy, and all the rest of it, everything that was associated with Port Royal. Kind of cut forward to this earthquake in 1755 in Lisbon, and that caused, I suppose, to put it lightly, a lot of head scratching in Europe, because you had this city that was absolutely devastated by this earthquake, and it wasn't on the kind of colonial periphery. So it wasn't, you know, I'm sure there was lots of people who were regarded as less than savory characters in Lisbon, but nothing like Port Royal, this town which had this extremely lurid reputation. And lots of people, I think as well, because the earthquake took place at a time when people were literally at the time of day when people were heading to mass, they couldn't, a lot of people really struggled to wrap their heads around how this had happened to a Christian capital at a time when people were actually going to church. And so this causes lots of consternation, provokes a lot of thought in that period of the European Enlightenment, where people start to think differently about these events. And that's not to say that they entirely abandoned in the 18th century a religious understanding of these events. You know, people talk about a kind of deist perspective, which is to say that these events are still seen as a product of a divine design, but the ways in which the disasters take place, they operate, could be something that could be understood, and people work to that end. And I think the other reason why the Lisbon earthquake is so interesting in 1755 is because, as the people of the town who survived tried to pick up the pieces, the government actually steps in and seeks to rebuild Lisbon in, as far as possible, a kind of a scientifically grounded and more seismic proof way. It's the what becomes known as the Pombal style in Lisbon. So, you know, that's one event that I touch on in the book, that tries to highlight the way in which there's this shift happening, provoked by big events like the Lisbon earthquake. But again, it's, you know, as a historian, it's hard to get a sense of who did believe then that these were events that could be understood, that were potentially had a scientific origin that could be understood, and who thought they were religious. Well, lots of people who are publishing, you know, that we can find in the historic records, start to obviously engage in this new study and move away from a providential understanding of disaster. But as we'll see, you know, people on the colonial periphery, not so much. So it's uneven. But like I say, kind of coming back, you know, to really get to answer the question, really, the 18th century is this transitory moment, like I say, provoked by big events like the Lisbon earthquake. You know, people are starting to think differently.
Mm. The timing of the mass, I think, is a really interesting sort of key part of that. So thank you for explaining how these things came together. Before we move on, though, I do want to kind of poke at something you mentioned a little bit, that idea that the providential conception, the deist idea, lasts longer in fringes like the British Caribbean than in other places. Why do you think that is?
So, it's very interesting. I think there's a physical element of distance, right? When people are thinking differently, say in the aftermath of the Lisbon earthquake, that emerges in, you know, a big exchange of letters and scientific discussions that are happening over Europe as people get this news and react to it and process it and think about it. When things are happening in the Caribbean, we know we're really at maybe a month or two or possibly even longer distance in terms of the time it takes to travel there for news to be received. So there's that element. There's the kind of the practical element of the knowledge exchange, and these discussions are slowed down. But the people, the sorts of people who are having those discussions in Europe, but also not the sorts of people, out in the periphery, like I say, you know, Jamaica, Port Royal, the previous capital, had a very unsavory relationship. So this is not where the scientific minds of Europe are situating themselves. There's that element. And I think also, as we see, in the 18th century and into the 19th century, colonial officials, there's this kind of interesting kind of two sides to how they look at these disasters in terms of, are they understanding them scientifically or providentially? What I found a lot when I was studying records from this period is, and it took me a while to kind of think about this, was that the colonial officers, when they're talking to themselves or they're talking to London, this is particularly in the period that I cover in the 19th century, they're not talking about these disasters in a providential way. They're talking about them as events to be dealt with, to cope with, and to build back from. They don't seem to be talking about it, in using religious language when they're talking amongst themselves. But when, as you'll see, if you read the book, there's lots of times where colonial governors will, in the immediate aftermath of a hurricane or whatever, will issue an official proclamation to the people in the colony. And those proclamations are really tinged with religious language. And they are really, particularly in the early 19th century, the first third of the 19th century, framing the disasters as providential events. And I was thinking for a while, why are they not talking about them in a providential manner between themselves, but when they're going to these public facing proclamations? And the more and more I looked at the sort of language in there, was the conclusion I came to really was that religion played this kind of role as a kind of an arm of colonial control. Effectively, what the language in these proclamations is saying, well, this disaster has happened. There's amazing phrases like the dire disposer of events, is how divine power is talked about in some of these proclamations. And it's basically using that providential frame to make a call for calm and saying, look, the dire disposer of events has brought this hurricane to the island. Be glad that you are alive now, and also basically behave yourself so that no more worse tragedies are visited upon us, upon the island. So I think there's that. That's what's happening in the public facing proclamations, is kind of saying, look, this is a big outside force that's caused this disaster. And now, particularly when we're thinking about the central division in Caribbean life in this period between plantation owners and overseers and white sources of power versus African Caribbean people, enslaved and then later apprenticed and later free, that division, these proclamations are kind of like a call for calm and like a reminder of this higher power, basically. And so that is one of the reasons I think this, at least this providential framing of disaster, persists in the Caribbean, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And I have to say, reading snippets of the proclamations in the book, some of them are incredibly dramatic, which is really interesting to think about kind of in the immediate aftermath of death and destruction. As you said, this idea of sort of behave yourself, it could get worse almost in some senses.
And just to add on to that, it's just kind of tweaked in my mind, you know, there'll be lots of times where it will say, you know, as a reminder to all people of the island, you know, think about the duties that you owe each other as Christians. And so it's kind of like religious also, you know, religion becomes, you know, because one of the main themes we see in the book is that these disasters provoke big fear in the white minority control of controllers of these colonies, that they're going to face some form of kind of threat to that control in the chaos that follows these disasters. And so there's always these kind of reminders that, oh, actually, ignore the very obvious divisions of power in this colony. Remember your duties as Christians to one another. Calm, you know, stressing that element.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And so then it becomes a question, you know, with Lisbon, it's about, well, actually, how do we understand the natural world? Whereas what we're seeing here is more religion being used as a tool to maintain power hierarchies.
Yes, definitely. And that really, you know, gets to one of the central themes of the book, is how those power hierarchies become so much more exposed in these moments of chaos or vulnerability for the white minority.
So I'd love to ask about that, because to me, one of the ways that this exposure was particularly highlighted was in reading about kind of what happened immediately after the disaster, what sort of help was asked for. Because today, again, we're used to this. We're used to, oh, please send water or medicine or food or whatever. And you don't really hear calls anymore about, please remember your Christian duty. You know, that's not what the aid requests sound like. But in the example you've just given us, I mean, none of those examples talk about please donate food to your neighbors, right? It's a very different type of conception of aid. So what kind of aid was requested? Who was asking for it? Who was meant to receive it? What usually happened to these requests?
Yeah, so I guess to that first point then, who was asking for aid? Well, in a way, obviously we know that the reality would have been that everybody would have been asking for aid in some form. No, that's what makes these events so interesting, is that white or black, rich or enslaved, everybody is affected by these events. But ultimately, the people who can make the requests for external aid are the people who are literate, have access to, you know, channels of government, communications with Britain and neighbouring colonies. So ultimately, it's the planter-dominated assemblies, particularly in the first kind of third half of the 19th century, and also the colonial officers and governors on the ground. Those are the people who are making those external requests for aid. And what are they asking for? Well, their first recourse pretty much always is for any form of preserved food that can be sent. So that's usually things that are salted or potted, so salted fish, salted beef, things that are potted, so sealed in some way, usually with lard. Preserved food that can be sent as soon as possible and will last. And this preoccupation with food is really, you know, it's a result of two things that are explored in the book, is that obviously, you know, food is the thing that will drive people to take action, right? Hungry people are people who take action, that people who are, you know, disregard set rules and laws and these sorts of things. So there's always an urgency in the letters that you read from planters and colonial officials that food, the absence of food, will provoke a riot, a contestation of their authority, whatever. So that is one of the things they're always asking for, that straight away. And the other thing is, you know, and again, this is, you know, talked about in the book, and we might touch on this also later, is that these islands were in effect, really heavily import dependent already. If we think about the British Caribbean, you know, one of the central industries, really the most central industry of the British Caribbean, was sugar plantations. Obviously, there are other crops like coffee, for instance, but ultimately, sugar is the biggest crop because, in many ways, it's the most profitable. And what the planters did was cover basically all usable arable land with plantations that they could. And so in these moments when these disasters happened, they don't have much food stored. And that's a bit of a mindset thing we might also talk about later, but they don't have much food stored up. So it seems often that they take what food they have stored up for themselves and then make these desperate calls for external sources of food to come in. And in addition to food, the other things they often kind of desperately requesting, particularly we see after volcanic eruptions, is clothes also, particularly after volcanic eruptions, because those events, more so than hurricanes, which might soak your clothes after the rain, volcanic eruptions are burning people's clothes basically away. And so those were in huge need as well. And so, yeah, we also see big requests for clothes. And then later down the line, you know, in the months that follow, as they've moved away from the very kind of desperate need for food in particular, then we start to see requests for timber, for rebuilding, and shingles and slates and this sort of thing for roofing. And then I guess we might also talk about financial aid, again, made requests particularly by planters and colonial officials. And this is something that's explored a lot in the book, a very long, protracted process of negotiation, one of the kind of many sites of negotiation that are talked about in the book, between really in a kind of a four-way complex negotiation where we have usually planters saying, I would like some money from the British government to rebuild these sugar plantations. We need that money to employ or to put, in the early period of the 19th century, enslaved African Caribbean people back to work, because we're terrified that they might try and contest our authority. Colonial officials then mediating the claims made by planters and sending them on to the British government, who and the colonial office, which, you know, as we may also talk about, are often unwilling to meet and don't trust the estimations of losses made by the planters in the Caribbean. So that kind of sums up the sort of aid that is coming in or being requested. And then on your point about who actually gets that and where it goes, well, in all cases it goes to the colonial officers and the planters. It goes to, you know, the white minority elite, and they, as a recurrent theme throughout the book, they withhold it. Basically, they often withhold it, and they only begin to distribute it once they are confident that the African Caribbean population is not going to contest their authority. And that, you know, we usually see these situations where they say, well, if you clean the streets, if you bury bodies to prevent, for instance, the spread of disease, if you start rebuilding things, when you do that and you submit to our authority again, then we'll begin the distribution of limited amounts of, you know, preserved salted foods and clothes, and potentially some building materials to rebuild your own lodgings. So that's the kind of process. And we do see hints in various, particularly of the Quakers that visited the Caribbean in the 1830s after emancipation to look. They were going there to observe what the conditions of life were like after slavery. And we see in some of their accounts hints. They say, oh, I visited, for instance, one that came to mind was a recording of a visit to Barbados after this, many years after this giant hurricane in 1831. And they found that lots of the building materials or the money have not really been distributed at all to the African Caribbean population. It's been hoarded instead by the planters. So yeah, in respect to how that gets distributed, from what I could glean in my research, poorly, as you perhaps might expect. And there's very little oversight by the British government about where that money goes once it is agreed upon.
And of course, that's by design, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in a lot of senses, I mean, that is clearly by design. So I don't really have any questions about kind of why did they do it that way, right? Unfortunately, the answer is pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the stuff that they're asking for, food that is preserved, clothing, building materials, none of those, I mean, you've already made the point, right? None of those go bad quickly. So if you're going to hoard it, why not kind of ask for 5 years worth and then you've got your hoard ready, given that, you know, these sorts of disasters happen sort of on an annual basis? Why, when they know that they're probably going to do it this way, they know what they're going to ask for, they know the stuff they're asking for lasts a while. Even with all that, I was really surprised to read just how little sort of advance planning there was, given how frequently the disasters are. I mean, surely they don't want to be asking for these things every year.
Yeah, it's a question that was a real essential question in my research. That really kind of, I suppose, intrigued me for a long time, was why was there so little forward planning, particularly, you know, for hurricanes, which occur on a basically annual basis. You know, the severity differs from year to year, but you can pretty much guarantee that, you know, one of these colonies is going to be affected by a hurricane every year. And it was through a long process of thinking about this. Now, as I mentioned in the book, there are individuals, somebody like a famous Jamaican planter, Simon Taylor, who do go to some effort to store food, as he puts it, quote, to prevent want, even in case of storms, right? But he's singled out, as somebody else had studied his kind of stockpiling, another scholar, Nicholas Crawford. He really singles him out and saying that he's a real exception. He's more careful than others. He's a wealthy planter. He's more careful than others. And I think one of the things I kind of argue in the book, really, is that, pardon me, is that there's multiple factors at play here that kind of explain why they don't kind of forward plan to the same degree. I think there's a first aspect, which is we have to think about absenteeism. So the people who often own these plantations aren't in the Caribbean. They're absentee, as the name would suggest, and they're in Britain, exercising their power in Parliament and building, you know, big stately homes and huge estates in Britain. So there's a kind of practical aspect of that. They're not directly affected by like the kind of visceral nature of these events. So maybe they're not thinking about them in that same way, thinking, oh, we need to prepare for this, because they're not actually there. And I think the other thing is that for the people who were there, often a theme I explore a lot in the book is they didn't really see the Caribbean as a place that they were going to stay long term. As planters, you know, they didn't see it as a home. And I contrast this to French colonists. I got some of the really interesting accounts of how kind of French planters saw the French Caribbean, and they were very much attached to that and saw that as their home, even if they were born there, in contrast to these British colonists, and in contrast to obviously their, you know, relatively close neighbors like in the 13 colonies later America. They don't see it as a place where they're going to develop the Caribbean in the long term. They go there to set up a plantation and set in chain a process by which they're going to make lots of money, and most of them are really quite desperate to get back to Britain and get to that business of building big estates. And so I think in many ways there's just a neglect. These people campaign to get some relief sent over there after disasters, but effectively their goal here is to make as much money as possible from these plantations. So they're willing to basically do it on the cheap. They will spend as much as they need to, but not really more than that. And particularly as we go into the 19th century, the plantation class is notorious for their indebtedness. So I think really they were chancing it often, that maybe a bad hurricane wouldn't happen this year, and therefore they didn't need to spend lots of money thinking about how their buildings were constructed and thinking about what they were stockpiling and this sort of thing. So I think really it came down to what I refer to in a way in the book as a plantation mindset that's wholly profit driven, and they wanted to cut corners where possible. And going back to the, you know, deeply racialized nature of the labor employed on plantations, obviously enslaved in the first third of the 19th century and later apprenticed and then free, they didn't view, you know, if they weren't willing to invest beyond the necessities for making profit in their plantation, they also didn't view African Caribbean people clearly in a way that when I'm going to invest for your welfare. You know, they fought every step along the way many of the welfare measures that followed the abolition of the slave trade in the 1807. There's a period in the 1820s where Britain attempts some kind of welfare, kind of very limited, it must be said, welfare policies for enslaved people in the Caribbean, and they fought those every step of the way. So I don't think they were going to suddenly start thinking about stockpiling food for the benefit of the African Caribbean population because they had fought their welfare every step. But they fought impositions to take seriously some, but however small degree, their welfare every step of the way. And I don't think they were going to change despite the frequency of these disasters.
Thank you for explaining that. I also found it kind of just inexplicable. Like, why aren't they doing this? But actually, reading the book, listening to that explanation, it does, in fact, make rather a lot of sense. I'd love to kind of now pick up something you mentioned earlier that we've not gone into much, which is this idea that disasters create this massive fear for the white minority class that their power hierarchy will be challenged. Can you walk us through sort of what that looked like in some of these instances? You know, what were they scared of? What actually happened? What did they try and do about it?
Yeah, so I think in a way, the best place to start answering this question is thinking about what is life like for African Caribbean. How does power work in the 19th century Caribbean when there's not a disaster? That is to say, for most of the 19th century, particularly obviously during the period of slavery, life centers on the plantation. And the plantation, and I'm paraphrasing a scholar whose name I forget here, but the plantation effectively functions as like an outdoor panopticon. So it's an outdoor prison in which, because of the mass deforestation, you can have white overseers on horseback patrolling the plantation, and they can have huge lines of sight over the whole plantation grounds. So the plantation is this concentrated, disciplined, effectively open-air prison where the white minority, and they are really, really in the minority, can exert very totalizing, you know, strong totalizing control over the African Caribbean population. And they are heavily policed. You know, one of the things I talk a lot about is their movement in everyday life. Most enslaved people aren't allowed to leave the plantations without express permission, usually a written pass from an overseer or plantation owner. So their movement is really heavily controlled. Where they can and can't go is really, really heavily controlled. And they're constantly observed. And so when you have a disaster, if we think about, you know, going to most common, a hurricane, which it completely stops all these rhythms which control and regulate life for African Caribbean people, and it brings chaos that this white minority was suddenly very terrified of. Well, all the sugarcane, you know, in the case of a hurricane, all the sugarcane has just been mowed down by these huge winds. There's flooding everywhere. Maybe there's landslides. Maybe the horses that the overseers usually ride around on and use to keep people rounded up, maybe they've been killed in the course of the hurricane. All the rhythms are suddenly out of whack about, okay, this is when you have to turn up, you know, from your lodging, you're expected to be on you're expected to be on the plantation at this time and work until sundown. And then you have all these other duties, which control and regulate every aspect of your life, under constant observation, and then suddenly a hurricane might come along and the very plantation house itself is completely knocked down. The overseers and maybe the plantation owner, if they survive the hurricane, which they may well not survive the hurricane, are shorn of all of their kind of accoutrements of their control. I mentioned, you know, being able to ride around on a horse, but maybe the weapons that they own, the guns that they own, these sorts of things suddenly, you know, might, on a practical level, might be soaked with rainwater. I can't fire a gun now. I can't use that as a threat. But also you've lost they've potentially lost the kind of visual markers of their authority. Like I say, their plantation house might be destroyed. They're not wearing, you know, fancy clothes or whatever it is that they usually kind of build this air of authority. So these disasters come along and they knock on away all these kind of rhythms of work and control and monitoring that take place. And like I mentioned earlier, hunger, which so often followed these disasters, whether it was a hurricane eruption or an earthquake, are the three kind of main disasters I study in this book. You know, hunger, of course, people are driven to survive. So if there is no food to be found on the plantation after a storm, people are going to leave the plantation and they're going to go looking for it. And often people migrated to small, because there often were small in the Caribbean, urban centers, looking for food. And suddenly you start to, again, to have a situation that brings a lot of anxiety in white authority, which is you have large groups of African Caribbean people now getting together. Maybe they're demanding food, they're looking for food. And suddenly you can really understand why, okay, the white minority, they might lose control of this situation. So like I say, yeah, to really get to the heart of it, these disasters just, they brought chaos and they upended all of the rhythms and the methods through which control was exerted. And, you know, particularly those things like limiting people's movements off plantations was designed so that large groups of people couldn't get together. And of course, after a disaster, that's what people start to do. And we see colonial officers and governors through the course of the book trying to find different ways to disperse people from urban centres and get them out and get them back on the plantations and this sort of thing. So that really is where lots of this fear comes from.
That's very helpful for taking us through. Thank you so much. I want to kind of think about, though, how that changes, or maybe perhaps more importantly, doesn't change. Because as you've mentioned a few times, during this time period, we have the abolition of the slave trade, which is, of course, separate from the abolition of slavery. And then, of course, the abolition of the ill-fated apprenticeship program that tries to maintain slavery under a different name for a few years. How do these three different kind of official big deal changes, to what extent do they actually change these dynamics and these disaster responses in the British Caribbean?
Yeah, I suppose one of the key themes of the book is to say that these events that you've mentioned, they do change some aspects of how disasters are responded to, but there is a key theme of continuity, and this kind of comes to the part of the title about negotiating freedom. And we often see after these disasters in the period after slavery that the colonial officials and, you know, the planters that held positions in government and planters more broadly are trying to find ways that allow them to exert a similar level of control over the African Caribbean population that they once did during the period of slavery. So, for instance, in the period of slavery, one of the disasters talked about at length in the book is the 1831 hurricane in Barbados. It's hugely devastating hurricane. And we see that fear play out there as lots of people head to the capital of Barbados after the hurricane looking for food, etc. And so a militia is deployed by the government, which basically tours the plantations of the island and threatens violence to people who leave the plantations. And it's exactly this control, attempt to recontrol people's movement and attempt to submit to get people to submit to white authority in forms of work that persists through the 19th century beyond slavery. So we often see these kind of, what I've termed in the book, I think, work for relief schemes take place. The two key examples that really stand out to me are 1898 in Barbados after another hurricane there, and after the 1907 earthquake in Kingston in Jamaica. So we see officials, as I kind of mentioned before, withholding relief that's really needed in terms of particularly food, and saying you can receive this aid, you can receive this food once you come and clean streets. So, clean streets, bury bodies, and engage in often what was really dangerous labor. If you think about a partially damaged house from a hurricane or partially damaged from an earthquake, employing people to pull this down would be, really, really dangerous. And so that is one of the key threads of continuity, is that after these disasters in the post-slavery period, we see the colonial officials attempting to exert particularly control over movement, control over where people can go, and to kind of lock them in to forms of labor using the food, the clothing, the shelter that they might desperately need to do so, and say, well, you're going to withhold that until you submit and you resume this kind of the normal way in which things are done, in which the white minority are in control, in charge of your movement, etc. So we see the reimposition of those, or the attempted reimposition of those after these disaster events throughout the 19th century. And in terms of kind of, I suppose you mentioned there, think about the kind of reactions, what actually does happen. Well, one of the things I found really striking is that throughout the course of the book, in many ways, the white fear of a contestation of their authority doesn't really materialize. And in a way, that kind of shocked me, given the severity of some of these events and given the hardships and the suffering that followed these events in terms of lack of food, lack of shelter. But I think what I increasingly found when I was able to get kind of firsthand accounts of what people were witnessing after these disasters is that actually, far from, being desirous of contesting white authority, much of the African Caribbean population, well, that hunger that we've talked about so much, but, obviously limited their action. People were much more focused simply on just surviving the reality of life after the disaster, rather than putting themselves in the face of more danger trying to contest white authority. But also there was a particular kind of first-hand account from that hurricane in 1831 I previously mentioned, where somebody talks about walking around the streets of Bridgetown, the capital of Barbados, after the hurricane. And I think the writer uses this kind of like dramatic phrase that the hearts of all were charged with distress. And I think often what you find is that people had lost so much after these events, particularly, of course, the most vulnerable, the African Caribbean population, their houses, their possessions, and obviously lots of their family members, their friends. They'd lost so much after these events that, like I say, people weren't interested, however angry they might be, they weren't interested in contesting white authority in any really meaningful, joined up way. And we do see incidences, particularly where it's felt that colonial officials are being particularly perniciously cruel with how they're withholding aid. We do see instances, particularly in 1898 in the Bahamas in 1866, where on various little out islands, colonial officials who are pretty much entirely on their own are forced, basically, much to their annoyance, to give away the food for free because there is a threat that people will just take it from them. They're not willing to submit to working and they will just take it to them. But overwhelmingly, I think, through the course of everything I studied, I think that was the sense that came across, that these events were just so devastating, particularly for the most vulnerable, the African Caribbean population, that the appetite, however angry they might have felt about their kind of deteriorating treatment after these disasters, the appetite wasn't there. The And people were simply really focused on just trying to survive the hardships that follow these events, because, you know, the hurricane might be 12 hours of wind and rain, but the hunger and the rebuilding that followed for weeks afterwards, and people clearly having experienced these events so regularly, that was where their focus lay.
Very helpful to put all of that in context. I think that's one of the things I found really useful about the book, was kind of there's a lot of things happening in the same time period, and we often sort of don't put them all in the same conversation, if that makes sense. You know, we talk about kind of environmental history, we talk about political history of abolition, but we don't always put them together. So that's a really helpful piece of what I think the book is doing. Likewise, I'd love for you, if you could, to tell us a little bit about, obviously, in some senses, this is all happening quite a long time ago, and there's many aspects in which these circumstances are not the same as they are now. On the other hand, legacies are real. And these sort of quite nasty power hierarchies, the lack of planning, the sort of, oh, well, these things just happen and it's got nothing to do with us. Well, except for the fact that kind of how you run a plantation has a lot to do with environmental degradation. So what are some of the legacies of this 19th century pattern of disaster response?
Yeah, so I think you kind of touched upon one of the key ones that I really tried to highlight in the book, is the ecological damage that took place as a result of, you know, centuries of plantations is something that still really affects the Caribbean to this day. So, you know, talked briefly and mentioned briefly earlier about deforestation. So, you know, sugar plantation, to grow a monoculture en masse like that, needed huge clearance of existing forest, jungle, etc. So there was mass deforestation. I think one of the things that always stuck with me, that really shocked me from my research in this area, so in the 17th century, Barbados begins to be settled from 1625 onwards, and the early descriptions of the colonists arriving in Barbados is that basically there's the shore and then there's jungle right from the shoreline, basically almost impenetrable jungle covering the whole island of Barbados. And then, roughly speaking, by the 1670s, the extent of the deforestation is such that the island is now reliant on imported timber to build anything. That's how much they've chopped down. And by, you know, the 18th century, descriptions of Barbados basically describe the island as one large sugar plantation. That's how deforested the island has been. I mean, it's really mind blowing. And there was other islands were severely deforested. Other islands, you know, such as Jamaica, had mountainous regions that were never fit for growing sugar monoculture in, and so areas of forest obviously did survive. But, you know, this deforestation and some of the direct effects of that, particularly loss of soil cohesion in the face of hurricane rains, etc., is something that really affects the region to this day. Deforestation in particular, you know, reports that I've read about, this is slightly going outside of the British Caribbean, but particularly Haiti, the deforestation continually causes huge landslides there. That have followed after earthquakes and hurricanes, and really exacerbated the loss of life and property. And I think what's interesting is a bit out of my area of kind of scholarly expertise, but lots of people have argued that as the Caribbean has kind of become increasingly reliant on tourism as a key source of money, rightly or wrongly, but why that's relevant now is that, you know, to quote another scholar whose name escapes me right now, you know, that the golf course has replaced the plantation. So where you had a huge area cut down for plantation, now those trees have been in it, there hasn't been a replanting effort, and the golf course has taken its place, another huge area of, in this case, grass monoculture. And it's, you know, it's embedding that legacy of ecological degradation that's followed on from colonialism. I think the other thing as well, to borrow Walter Rodney's term, as I do in the book, about colonial underdevelopment, is something that continues to affect the Caribbean. And this is, you know, this is something that's also clearly expressed in the calls for reparations for slavery, a recognition of how that enterprise of slavery and plantations underdeveloped these islands. It took money away from them, extracted resources from them for centuries, and it's left them underdeveloped. And obviously, that's one of the key reasons that they are, you know, making this claim for reparations now. And as much as I mentioned earlier that these islands were really heavily import dependent and they needed to bring this food in, the islands in the Caribbean remained import dependent. And I think that is in many ways a product of the ways that history of how the colonialism has configured their economies, that underdevelopment, that extraction of resources away from there. And it was really interesting to see, reading as I did at the time in the middle of the pandemic, you know, the UN was doing surveys and looking at where was vulnerable, particularly vulnerable to the COVID pandemic in that period. And one of the areas highlighted was the Caribbean. And one of the reasons why it was considered so vulnerable was, again, because it was heavily import dependent. And it really kind of struck me that was coming up in relation to an entirely different form of disaster than the sort of ones I've discussed in this book. But that kind of mode of economy was increasing, exacerbating that vulnerability in respect to COVID was so interesting, and that was being identified. Of course, not discussed in those terms, but I think that was clear to me having looked at that century of history and so much more in relation to the Caribbean. And, yeah.
Thank you for taking us through that. I think that's, again, one of the benefits of doing history, of being a historian, is that even if it's not mentioned in the news article, kind of having all that knowledge, you go, wait a second. I see some traces here. And so thankfully, you've let those of us listening to this into that a little bit as well. So thank you for sharing that expertise on that last question. As we have come up kind of essentially to the present, really, that leaves me only with my final question, which is, now that this book that you've been working on for such a long time is available for people to read, what might you be working on next?
Yeah, so I'm working on I think a really interesting project. It's something that's kind of briefly mentioned in the book. It's something I started researching. So in the conclusion of the book, I mentioned this hurricane that took place in what was known at the time as British Honduras, now Belize, in 1931. And I mentioned that as it acted really well as a coda for the book, because it was an instance, in this case, of a disaster provoking a different kind of response from the wider population of the colony. And I was really exploring, scholars of the Caribbean may know, and more broadly, that the 1930s was a huge period of labor unrest in the Caribbean. And British Honduras is one of the first places where this labor unrest really broke out. And I got really intrigued thinking about, well, how does this link to this hurricane that took place in 1931? And by 1933, this huge labor unrest has kind of exploded in the colony and spread around the rest of the Caribbean. And so I kind of mention a little bit in the conclusion of the book, a little bit of a link there. And that's what I'm really working on next, is exploring the linkage there in more detail between this hurricane in 1931 and the emergence of a labor movement, of a decolonial movement in British Honduras. And the other aspect of that I think is really interesting, that event in 1931, and I think this links into the anger that followed and why that might feed into the labor unrest, was that from my archival research, it's become increasingly clear that the British governor, John Burden of British Honduras, knew about the hurricane in advance, but decided, because the hurricane was going to make landfall on the same day of some planned celebrations, celebrating himself and his achievements as governor, that those celebrations should go ahead. And it seems from the archival record that he covered up basically the advanced warning knowledge that he was given about the imminent arrival of this hurricane in favor of making sure that these celebrations for him and for the British Empire more widely took place. And that decision resulted you know, directly in the loss of over 1,000 lives. So I'm really, those are the kind of two aspects working on this history of this event that I'm really wanting to explore in depth.
That does sound intriguing. Best of luck with that project as you continue to explore it. But of course, while you're working on that, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, Negotiating Relief and Freedom, Responses to Disaster in the British Caribbean, published by Manchester University Press. Oscar, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's such interesting questions and conversation. Thank you.